Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Needless to say, we are back. I hope you guys missed us from last week. It's been 2 weeks since we've been on air. We miss being on air and hope that you guys will be coming back. And so here we go. Before we took that week off, we were talking about restorative justice. And before that, we were talking about some different issues, all related to each other. It goes all the way back to September and the start of school. If you can recall, we started in September with discussing the issue of what is the purpose of education. And we spent a week talking about the purpose. Then we made a transition from just talking about the purpose in terms of how the purposes of education, and when I say education, I'm talking public education, have changed over the decades. Actually, it's like 100 and some odd years, 150 years or so. And so I was building up to where we are today, but it took some time in order to take us back to the basics. And the basic has always been, you have to understand what the purpose of education is, quote, at any given time. If you go back to the very beginning, Horace Mann pushing this notion of common school and the city, the state, the county, taking the responsibility to finance common school, there was a purpose. And as you go forward from that period, when we get to the point where there was a large influx of immigrants coming into the country, the purpose of education then was to provide a way to acculturate, to socialize, the socialization of these immigrants who came with different cultures, different backgrounds, to make them, quote, American, the Americanization of the immigrants. And in different periods, we've had different purposes and raised the question of the changing purposes of public education over the years. Then we went from there, we talked about, and all of this was within the context of the current war on public education, and how, in order to understand the war, the current war, you really, in my opinion, have to understand the purpose of education and how this war has its purposes to change the purpose of education. I don't mean to sound like I'm trying to be coy or anything, but basically that's how I see it, and that's how I think if you begin to think of it in terms of the purposes of education, you too may get a better understanding of the war itself, where we are in this war, and what both sides are doing. When I say both sides, both the public education community, that's the schools, the communities, the parents, the teachers, to some extent, the unions, the politicians, the general public who support and seek to defend public education from those who want to reform, as they say, public education. Reform in this context is another way of saying change the purpose of public education. Reform also is a misleading word because it's not to reform public education. It's basically to, again, my personal view of destroying public education for the purpose of erecting a privatized network of schools to deal with the notion of educating young people. So, and I also said in the past that when you're talking about education, never forget you're really talking about politics. Education has always been shaped, formed, born from politics. Its survival, its decimation is all within a political context. When I move from talking about the purpose of education back way back then, and it's the changing purposes through the years, I got to the issue of saving public education. And some of the things that are, quote, being done in an effort to, quote, save public education from destruction. And I went, to some extent, a little detail into different types of approaches to changing the purpose of education and the role of this thing called community schools. And if you recall, I identified different types of community schools and what their purposes were and how each of the various types of community school was looked at as a way to help save public education from destruction. That, to me, was an important area to go to because what we've seen over the last 30-plus years was the people who are calling themselves the reformers and those of us who are trying to survive their reform, we have this battle over, say that word again, purpose, and we, those of us who are trying to save public education, we are on the losing end, and we are trying to come up with strategies, programs that will help us defend ourselves and help us keep public education afloat long enough to the point where it will be able to go from the survival defensive to possibly on some type of offensive to save public education. And it's community schools is a strategy program now that is being used across the country with great results. And why the community schools have been seized upon as a vehicle or as a weapon to help save public education. community schools, regardless of the different kinds of community schools, they have some things in common. I talked about this. And one of the many things that they have in common is the school reaches out to the community and try and get the community to reach back and become partners in providing a better education, providing various services that the community needs. Hence, the community begins to see the school maybe in a different light, a more positive light, and hence, the community then seems to be more invested in saving their community schools. By that, I mean, maybe they're more likely to go out and vote. Maybe they're more likely to vote for candidates at the local, state, and national level that promise to help save public schools. And because now the community perspective of the public school is changing or has changed from either neutral, negative, to more positive, because the school is actually, quote, in their view, instead of community's view, actually doing something positive in the community, in addition to trying to now do more for the community's children. I'm slowing down because I'm saying a lot, and I want you to hopefully grasp this and stay with me here, so that that was a strategy, is a strategy. In addition to that, I talked about another, let's call it a movement. Then I talked about another movement, and that movement is this social justice movement. And I explained that when you use the word social, preceding and coming before justice, that's an adjective, and there are different types of efforts to bring about justice. There's racial justice, there's gender justice, economic justice, political justice, but the word social justice encompasses all of those individual movements for justice. And so, and the importance of this social justice movement in terms of by embracing a social justice movement, again, the education system is reaching out to the community. Maybe not just the local community, but the larger community. And saying that we are committed to social justice. We are committed to racial justice. We are committed to economic, political, legal justice, climate justice. We have your interests at heart, as well as educating your children. And in some areas, this is working, but the social justice movement is not as extensive as the community school movement. There are far fewer schools, and I don't know of a single district that has come out and embrace the social justice movement as part of their vision, their mission, and the goal. Individual schools have, both public and charter schools, but very, very minimal compared to the community schools. But we have two I'm going to call a movement all aimed at trying to combat the progress the other side is making in its effort to destroy public education. Then I went from social justice to restorative justice. That was the last show. And I was saying that, well, actually I raised a question. Can basically social justice help save public education? Can schools become the modern engine of social justice? In other words, can schools embrace social justice on a massive scale? And if, by implication, if so, then this would be a major weapon in the defense against the destruction of public education. I also raised the question, can restorative justice lead the way out of the school-to-prison pipeline? And that's where we are in this show, is moving from the broad concept of social justice to a more specific area of which restorative justice, something akin to social justice, play an important role in the defense of public education. Now, let me set this up. And we've talked about this over the last 3.5 years. Public schools have been portrayed, especially over the last 15 years, but even going back to the 80s and that thing called the Nation at Risk, and then I have said taking it back to the late 50s, 57, I think, to be exact, when Sputnik was launched, when public education came under attack. Then in the 50s, and then more so in the 80s, and then full-out war in the 21st century, 2002 to be exact, with No Child Left Behind, and continued with Race to the Top. So that public education, and when I say public education, you can also think the local school district and the local school. You can even think in terms of the individual classroom. The public education had been hit from all sides. One of the things that the reformers have been able to do is to attack school teachers. Thus, the individual school teacher, the teachers at local schools and what have you, and accusing them as being principally responsible for children, and particularly urban children, not getting a quality education because the teachers themselves are not quality. And they've been successful. In urban centers, they've been able to convince black and brown parents, parents of poor children whose families are poor, that public education has failed them, and largely the teachers have failed them, and that if you get rid of these miserable teachers, or take your kids and put them in a different environment. They don't say that their teachers are probably even worse than, quote, their perception of the public school teachers. That's not part of the propaganda. That your kids are going to benefit from it, and you're going to benefit from it. The nation is going to benefit from it. So that teachers have become the scapegoat for the bad, quote, showing that kids have demonstrated over the years in terms of low test scores. Teachers are the blame. School is to blame. In comes restorative justice. In comes social justice and then restorative justice. And it's a different animal here. I'm only hesitating because we're getting into some abstractions here, and I want to make sure I do a better job in explaining this. And the bottom line here is that the question, can restorative justice play a role in saving public education? Can it change the perception? Can it deliver results that change the conversation? And in the process, can it then contribute to both defending, saving public education? That's where we're going with today's show. So how we'll get there is going to be my job to try and do it in such a way that everyone picks up the message that I'm talking about. But let's go back and do a back in the beginning kind of thing. Restorative justice, as I mentioned in the last show, is a different type of animal than the traditional, quote, approach to justice. The traditional approach to justice is retribution. You've done harm, you must be punished. The state must get its pound of flesh for your transgression. The criminal justice system, from its very beginning, I mean, going back hundreds of years, has been that approach. Punishment, retribution. Also, it was pretty much developed from the experience with adults. Then children were subjected to the same type of punishment and retribution as the adults were in their society. And when you come here to America in the 16th, the 17th, 1800s, we didn't have laws like we supposedly have today to protect children and imbue children with rights that the Constitution applies to them as well as to adults. Children were being subject to imprisonment. How about execution? At a very young age, harsh physical punishment. Somewhere around the late 1800s, 1900s, we sort of got, quote, the Enlightenment bug that children, quote, are children, and they should be treated differently than adults for their transgression. Hence, another movement comes about to create juvenile justice that is different from criminal or adult justice. Juvenile justice was aimed at rehabilitation, that children, especially children of a very young age, were capable of being rehabilitated. And through this rehabilitation, they could be made ready to come back into the society, reentry. Very much different, folks, from the criminal justice. When I say criminal justice, think adult justice system, where we lock them up forever, where we execute them, where we brutalize them, and et cetera. There was this recognition that children were different from adults, hence they should be treated differently. The goals of the justice system should be different for them than for the adults. In a way, the early days of this juvenile justice system emerging, if you really get into restorative justice, you'll see, I believe, some parallels to way back then and what we're calling restorative justice today. That's just an aside, something that it hit me, a few weeks ago, months ago. I think I may have mentioned that when I was teaching in criminal justice, because I'd gone to law school, I taught a course, juvenile law and procedure. And it was during that course that I became aware of the juvenile justice system, its history, its mandates, its goals and means and et cetera, and how they differed from the adult criminal justice system. Also, during that time when I was teaching criminal justice, I saw the beginning of the push to change the juvenile justice system and merge it back into the adult criminal justice system, where it was punitive, not rehabilitative, and where the notion of charging, trying, and convicting kids at a very young age of life sentences, death sentences, was coming about during the 80s into the 90s. So back then we were getting away from anything similar to what we have today in terms of the movement for restorative justice, back to the old days of punitive justice. I also saw the coming of the prison analogy being applied to the schools. And this, I really want to take some time and get you to focus with me on this. It was during the 80s and into the 90s when this notion of zero tolerance, no excuses, started to penetrate the school system. Harsh reaction to minor offenses, being too loud, coming in a room after the bell has rung, be it a few seconds or what have you. Any kind of notion of disrespect for the teacher or for the rules, dress code violations, anything, resulted in punishment, suspensions, expulsions, you name it. We saw that coming. Now we're moving more. Then we get Columbine and was it 1999, I think it was? Then the floodgates open. We get what they call resource officers in school, cops in schools. We get metal detectors. We get dogs coming, going down the hallway sniffing lockers. You get random searches. You get kids being profiled and whole classes being randomly searched without search warrant, anything. You see that the prison and the analogy of the prison coming down to the schools, so that schools become analogous to prison. And let me give it to you in personal terms. I think it was back in April. I told you that I had gone to a one-day conference at a minimum security prison, federal prison in Pennsylvania. And when you get there, this prison sits way off the road, all clear, so they have a complete view of people coming supposedly into the prison ground as a security measure. The parking lot is way away from the building. That's another security measure. When you enter the door, you have personnel, guards at the counter. You have to sign in, show ID, and you have to prove that you had indicated to the prison that you were coming several days earlier so they could do background check, all these things. Then you go through a metal detector. Then you're escorted to, in this case, to a big gymnasium where the event was taking place. Guards all around, unarmed, because in prison the guards don't carry guns when they're around the inmate population, so that if the inmates were to jump and take the gun, they don't do that. So that, and when you're there, if you have to go to the bathroom, male or female, someone escorts you to the bathroom. They stand outside waiting for you to do your business and come back. Then they escort you back. And then when the event was over, again, in small groups, they put you in a group, and then they process you out. Then they walk you out to the door. That's what prison's like. We see that in our urban schools, and to some extent some of the suburban rural schools, but in our urban schools, so that the schools really look like, feels like a prison. A physical prison. Then you get the way in which the students are treated, the emotional, psychological impact of being in a prison. And I had mentioned previously, many schools or school districts have said that when the school day is over and students are leaving the building, that the schools now claim that a quarter of a mile from the school up to a half a mile from the school is still, you're in the school district zone, or whatever they call it, so that you can be stopped by school police or city police as if you were still in school. Your rights are still suspended until you step across whatever this imaginary line is that makes you now a civilian or a person who's no longer under supervision. So you have, this is the broad context. You have this all going on. And so here's where and how the connection between restorative justice, the school of prison pipeline, and the schools changing their perception, the schools, by changing their perception, become more favorably viewed by the community, and the school and the community become allies and a common cause, and that common cause is to save either the community public school or the whole district from becoming a privatized network of schools. So we have, hopefully, a framework set up here so that we can see how the schools have become like prison. There's a nexus between the schools and the prison, hence the notion of the school-to-prison pipeline, and the question of, can this restorative justice help save public education? And by doing so, can the school-to-prison pipeline be dismantled by the schools via, among other things, this restorative justice concept and practice? Let me say that again. Can restorative justice practice throughout a school or a district, can it contribute to the dismantling of this thing that we call the school to prison pipeline? And I'm going to give you a heads up, and I'll mention this towards the very end. I think it can, not by itself, and I'll explain this later, but I think it can be a major player in this thing called the school to prison pipeline being dismantled. I think it can play a much, much larger role and a more bigger picture than just dismantling the school to prison pipeline. And I'll get to that. So, let's talk about how the school has become what I've said in the past, an incubator for the prison system. How the school is growing future inmates for what we call the prison industrial complex, like the military industrial complex. Going, if you want to go back to 2002 and the signing of No Child Left Behind, when I have said in the past, that was a formal, in my view, the formal declaration of war on public education. Remember I said earlier, the Nation at Risk report was a stealth war, covert war on public education. And before that, Sputnik initiated a covert, limited war on public education. But when you go back to No Child Left Behind, this is what you get. You get, as you know, high-stakes testing. You get zero tolerance. You get new excuses. You get the criminalization of student behavior. You get value-added measures. You get privatization. You get school closures, turnaround, takeovers, restructuring. You get administrators and teachers being pressured to deliver on high-stakes testing. And you get a mentality and a practice of pushing out students who you perceive won't test well, even if it's just pushing them out on the day of a test, a statewide test, or pushing them out before so that they don't bring down the test scores. So you get this pushing out. You get pushing out in the form of suspensions, expulsions. You get pushing kids into special ed, pushing them into alternative schools, when basically alternative disciplinary schools. They don't use the word disciplinary, but that's what we're talking about when we start talking about alternative schools. And so that you get that, you get being counseled out, where child's parents are told that this really is not a good setting for your child, and you need to seek a different setting. You get all these things coming from the war itself. And of course, then you get the real long-term pressure of schools not being equitably funded. Some school districts receive more funds for educating students than others. And you get this unequal, inequitable financial arrangement where schools have to do more with less. And all of these, individually, collectively, they become part of the nexus. I use the word nexus, the connection here, that when you string them together, one, two, three, four, five, or more of them, what they end up doing is sometimes, some cases, actually putting kids out, other cases, leading to kids themselves dropping out, leading kids to go into truancy, and get picked up, introduced to the juvenile court system, hence the gateway to possibly future gateways to the adult criminal justice system and prisons. You get all of these things going. And as a result, you get from the community the perception that the teachers, the administrators, the districts don't care about their kids. They support, some communities support the dismantling of the public schools because they say you're providing a piss poor education, you're victimizing our children, you're pushing them out, you're encouraging them to set them up to drop out, you got cops in your school, you're brutalizing our kids, you should be dismantled. Good riddance. Now comes this notion of restorative justice. It did not come about directly in relationship to the schools. As I mentioned the last show, that restorative justice is a philosophy and a practice that goes back hundreds of years, and what we now call indigenous populations here in America, the Native Americans, Canada, and Africa, and other areas of the globe, they use this form of how they dealt with an infraction or a conflict between two individuals. They viewed it as something that the infraction basically was a harm to the entire community, and that the entire community then should get involved with finding a resolution. This approach is used now in adult prisons, even with inmates who are serving life terms. Inmates who are accused and convicted of violent crimes, including murder. It's being used in businesses. It's all across the board. There's this movement to move over to restorative justice. In the schools, what we have is when it's practiced, quote, the way in which it's laid out in terms of its philosophy, restorative justice is, one, it's not punitive. It's something that's supposed to mitigate, reduce suspensions, mitigate, reduce expulsions. It's something that, if, again, implemented comprehensively, encourages students to want to come to school and to stay in school. It's something that research has shown that those schools that have implemented a restorative justice program, there is, in many cases, a reduction of conflict. There is a rise in attendance. There is more, say, harmony among the students with each other and teachers with students, students, administration. There is a rise in students' engagement in their learning. In other words, there's some positive things that research is and has shown that can come from a restorative justice program, and that there's something to be said about the potential role of restorative justice in not only saving education, but having a much far further impact than just education. With my time that I have left, look at what I'm saying in terms of how it applies to the purpose. As I mentioned earlier, we start off in September dealing with the purpose and those issues of whether or not the purpose of education is no longer self-evident. When you introduce restorative justice, you're really messing with the purpose. You're taking a broader view of your role as a teacher and as an administrator and the role of the school and public education itself. You're not just teaching the ABCs anymore. You're not just teaching what we would call reading, writing, and arithmetic. You're not just teaching notions of moral character. And especially if you were in a religious school, you're reaching further. What I really want to impart is that restorative justice, I believe, can be a bridge to equity in schools, when I say schools, public education. However, if you look, if your school is into restorative justice, if you are a teacher who's been trained to be a restorative justice leader for, in your classroom and implementing restorative justice in your classroom, then you'll know what I'm talking about. There is a brand, I'm going to call it a brand, of restorative justice called critical restorative justice. Critical, like in when you were in college, be it undergraduate or graduate school, you took a course in critical philosophy, critical studies. You maybe even majored in critical studies. Critical, in this sense, is where you look at a phenomena. You look at it critically in that you are questioning this phenomena, the why, the how, the when. You're looking at it with a critical eye in terms of its purpose. Is it good? Is it bad? But most importantly, you're looking at it in terms of power, power structure, power relationships. And you're looking at it and saying, how does the power structure of the nation, the culture, the enterprise impact the individuals involved? That's what critical, and that's a broad definition of critical. But what you're doing when you do the critical analysis, you're asking those questions of why, and you're looking to see who is playing what role. In this case, we're talking about education. Why are black, brown, poor students suspended, pushed out, expelled 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times more than white students for the same offense? You're looking at the underlying structure. You're looking again at structure itself. You're also looking at the role of the structure, political structure, economic structure, cultural structure, historical structure, and how it shapes behavior. So you're not just looking at the individual student and say, oh, you're a bad student. You're looking at a bigger picture and saying how maybe the teacher's attitude, the teacher's training, the location of the school, the race climate in the city, in the community, could be impacting students' behavior, how their gender and attitudes towards gender, gender differences, and et cetera. What I'm trying to say here is that critical restorative justice, in my view, can help lead the way for students, teachers, admins to help bring about a more equitable school climate, structure. They can contribute to students learning more about themselves and the social cultural environment and how it contributes to their identity, themselves, and then help them better understand and to behave in such a way to help not only to stop the perpetuation of the nexus between school and prison, the school-to-prison pipeline, but they can also help dismantle it. I don't believe critical restorative justice by itself can do it. I think if we can combine the critical studies in the areas of sociology, race, law, political science, and an integrated curriculum that will help the students learn to analyze critically the social structure, being, you know, the social, the economic, the political, the legal structure that contributes to their behavior, shape their behavior, will help students going forward and correcting their behavior because they understand themselves and the world in which they live in, but they can also help then counter, dismantle this thing that we call the school prison pipeline. I think it's possible. I definitely think it's needed, and I'm hoping that we see more of this. Again, with the restorative justice, students learn to be accountable for their behavior, but they also learn about the structure of their society, their school, the social structure, and how that social structure contributes to shaping who they are, how they behave, how they got to the point of where they are at any given moment. But it also teaches them how to, going forward, to understand and to be able to deal more effectively with the system in which they live in. I'm not probably getting that over, but it also gives them a voice in this. It helps democracy, participatory democracy. It could be a powerful, powerful tool, and I believe it can help protect and save public education. My time is up. I got most of what I wanted to say in. I'm going to move to another area next week. I might come back a little bit more with this because I think it's very, very crucial. But time is up. Thanks, everyone. Have a good rest of this Sunday.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.